Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Going to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife today with Scott Craven. Scott, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Great to have him back, as he always comes on the first Wednesday of the month, and it's great to have him with us again today. You have a wildlife question? I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or via email at talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here. Happy December.
Yeah.
Hard to believe my two favorite months of the year are now gone for another 10 months.
October and November are wonderful months, aren't they? Oh, man. I tell you what, the deer season, the 9-day season is over. Hunters did pretty well out there.
They did. It was a case where, you know, we were coming off a disappointing season last year for a lot of people, and the harvest was down considerably. But we're back into positive territory, kind of like the stock market this year. Statewide, these are the preliminary data for the 9-day, but statewide hunters registered 102,000 plus a few bucks, which was up 17% over last year, and 116,000 plus a few antlerless deer, which was up about 7%. Over 09. So it was a good season from that standpoint to see things turn around in the other direction, especially since, as we talked about a month or so ago, a lot of the northeastern part of the state had a no-does or no-antlerless deer regulation this year to try and rebuild the herd there. And, of course, things are still fairly confusing and unclear in the chronic wasting disease area over much of southern Wisconsin. But nevertheless, 621,000 people were apparently out there. That's the number of licenses that were sold, and they brought back 218,000 deer. And when you add the bull kill, which was apparently very strong this year, onto this and all the seasons that are yet to come, it should be a pretty good deer harvest.
We had Mary Beth sent a note to my Facebook page and wondered, she was out deer hunting last week, during the season, and one or two turkeys were gobbling, and she was wondering, what are they gobbling, or just does hope spring eternal here?
Well, hope springs eternal all the time, but it's not uncommon to hear an occasional grouse drumming or turkey gobbling in the fall of the year. Maybe young birds are trying out their stuff for next spring, but it's not unheard of, but it's also not normal breeding season either, as she well knows.
She also wondered about the predation on deer and turkeys by coyotes, seeing a lot more coyotes.
That's a common concern right now, Larry. In fact, we were just talking about it around the office this morning, that coyotes in the upper Midwest have been doing very well. Some of our hunting groups saw coyotes during the deer season. I suspect a lot of people did. And there's a little growing unrest that these animals are having some impact. I think most of what I've heard is in the deer context, but turkeys may be at some risk too. But as a reflection of that concern and a general reflection of concern over the true impacts of black bears, as that population has now burgeoned, wolves, and they're doing very well, and of course coyotes, which are far more abundant than either of the previous two animals. The DNR is embarking on a pretty major predator investigation to try and answer some of these questions. But yes, there is some concern. How real it is and how much impact it has is yet to be determined.
We have every line full, so let's go to the phones and to Bill and to Pierre first. Bill, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a small pond in my front yard that grows a lot of duckweed, and every year at about mid-October, a little flock of ducks comes in and spends the month eating duckweed. Mm-hmm. This year they had a muskrat that would just nonstop harass the ducks, and I just wonder what was going on.
Well, apparently the muskrat was a little territorial about its pond. You know, whether or not the muskrat was just active, or was it, in your opinion, was it visibly going at the ducks?
Oh, yeah, visibly going after the ducks. Swim,
well,
swim up, make them fly.
And how big is this pond?
Oh, it's about an acre, maybe.
Okay. Well, you know, obviously in a place like that, you have a lot of resident wildlife, and in some cases, certain species become a little more protective. And if you have an overly aggressive muskrat, which this one may well have been, I guess I'm not surprised by that. It's not common to have harassment of different species. You see fields with turkeys and deer feeding side by side, and occasionally the deer might take a kick at a turkey or whatnot.
Sure.
Or different species will run after each other. So it's a little unusual, but I don't think it's anything to get too too excited about. I think your ducks will be back just fine. Muskrat's longevity is not very great, so chances are that rat won't be around to cause the same problem next year.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Bill. Appreciate it. Norman in Wausau. On to you now. Hi, Norm.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have two questions, short. One is on shrews. We have a lot of them, apparently, because our golden retriever has been very diligently killing them this fall, the last few weeks in particular. And my concern is, are those beneficial for the environment in terms of getting rid of mice, or do they damage the bark on young fruit trees and berry bushes in the wintertime?
Well, Norman, it depends a little bit on what kind of shrews the dog's bringing home. If they're about the size of a mouse and they have a short, stubby tail and they're kind of a dark charcoal gray with a pointed snout, then that's the most common one you'd probably run into. That's called a short-tailed shrew.
And that's what they were.
Okay, well, there's a couple things to think about. Number one, those shrews have no interest whatsoever in fruit trees or plants of any kind. They eat only animal matter. And they will eat mice that are of at least their body proportions because that particular shrew has venomous saliva. It's the only venomous mammal we have. And they use that venom to subdue mice that are of similar size to them. So I caught a short-tailed shrew in my garage yesterday in one of my mouse trap lines trying to keep the white-footed mice at bay. And when that happens, I say, oh, darn it, I caught another shrew. I would rather not do that because they're of no problem as a household pest. And if they're in the shed or garage or barn at all, it's in there looking for mice and other foodstuffs, spiders or whatnot, that I'd just as soon not have around. So the bycatch of my mouse trapping operation or your dog's behavior is probably not doing a whole lot of good in terms of your local pest control interests. Now, the other thing to think about, of course, is if the retriever's catching these things, they are venomous. And if he's not quick about dispatching them and gets bitten on the lip or something, if you ever see the dog exhibiting some rather strange symptoms or it seems lethargic or its lips are swollen or there's some other problem, it may very well be related to the bite of that shrew. Okay?
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Well, we had one other question.
Oh, did you have one other question, Norm?
Yeah, on chickadees.
Oh, chickadees,
they
right.
They hoard food because we've got a sunflower seed dispenser, and they just empty out a couple quarts a day out of that thing, and I can't believe that they can eat all those sunflower seeds. So are they hoarding them for the winter or what?
Well, do you have any blue jays?
No.
No blue jays, because right now the blue jays are eating me alive. As fast as I can fill the feeders, they're hauling it away, and they do hoard it. The chickadees may to a certain degree, but usually they'll take a seed, fly to a bush, hammer it open, eat the seed, and come back and get another one. And if you've got a big flock, and they can be quite numerous, they can go through a lot of seeds. So it may be just be a number of very active chickadees right now, and they may be stashing a few of them too, but I don't think that's as big a problem as it is with some, and it's not necessarily a problem. That's just the way they get through the winter.
Yep. Thanks for calling, Norm. Appreciate it. Peter in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Nice to talk to you folks. Listen, before I get to my point, let me just advise the previous caller that if he's got problems, he should buy the shelled, coarse ground sunflower seed. The chickadees will eat those, but they don't make off with them. They don't hoard them. And he'll find he's actually spending less on sunflower seeds.
Okay.
Plus, the squirrels don't collect them to the same extent.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I wanted to talk about was the barbaric practice. Oh, I'm not opposed to hunting in general, but I am opposed to the barbaric practice of dog chasing bear hunting,
mm-hmm.
which seems to be practiced in Wisconsin, usually by people from out of state. Is there any chance that this practice can be banned, or is the hunting community so benighted with fear that they will not police their own?
Well, you've raised a couple of interesting points, Peter. First of all, I would not say that the bulk of bear hound hunting is out-of-state folks. This is a very popular, very strong activity within Wisconsin, and I think most of those are Wisconsin folks pursuing that particular form of bear hunting. Bears are either hunted by hunting over bait or by hound hunting, and they alternate from year to year in terms of who gets first shot at the hunting, but both types of hunting are pursued each year. We've had lots of calls over the year of people, particularly non-hunters, who are perhaps supportive of hunting, as you indicated, but who find this particular type of hunting not particularly palatable. And I understand that, but having said that, it is very popular, especially in the northern part of the state. The Bear Hunters Association is a very large and influential group. And when you mention hunters policing their own ranks, it would be unusual for, say, deer hunters to all of a sudden mount a campaign that, gee, we don't like this aspect of bear hunting, or we don't like duck hunters using electronic decoys, or whatever. That generally does not happen. And part of the reason is that there's a great deal of overlap amongst groups of hunters. A lot of bear hunters, I would guess most bear hunters, are probably also deer hunters,
yeah,
and so on and so forth. So hunters don't necessarily all speak with the same voice. They don't necessarily all participate in the same forms of hunting. So I wouldn't expect any pressure on different aspects of hunting, whether it's electronic calls or gadgetry or use of hounds or baits or anything else. Wouldn't necessarily expect that to come from within the hunting community, but rather from without. And whether there's any future in that concern for the folks who are concerned about it, I really can't say.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Peter. Appreciate it. Jim in Winnebago County, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jim.
Morning, Larry. Scott, I have a cabin up in Iron County that has sided with Texture 111 stain. It's been there for about 10 years and never had a problem until last year. And then I had a porcupine decide that he wanted to chew on the siding.
Mm-hmm.
Short of lead poisoning, is there anything that I can do to prevent that from happening again?
Well, first of all, you took me by surprise, Jim. I thought we were headed down the woodpecker trail here, but porcupines are equally problematic, but T111 siding is notorious for woodpecker problems. We'll get to that later in the show. As far as the porky's concerned, I'm assuming most of the damage is probably occurring on edges and corners and things like that?
Right at the base of the deck. I would crawl right up on the deck and then just basically kind of went around the edge of the cabin.
Yeah. Well, There are a couple of alternatives. There are some taste-based repellents that work on the basis of one uses a fungicide called Thyram, and then there are some that are based on capsaicin, which is the active ingredient in hot sauce. That both of those seem to deter chewing. So it's possible that you could apply such repellents on the siding. I would make sure that it's not going to discolor or disfigure whatever natural surface you have, so I'd do a little test application first if you were going to try that. That's one possibility. The other is since most rodents, like porcupines, need or want a cutting edge, they don't attack a smooth face of siding, that you can armor plate the edges and corners and so forth either by just cutting a 6 or 8 inch strip of hardware cloth and stapling that right on the T111. Or using, if it's just the very edge, you can get a drywall corner, not the plastic, but metal, if you can find it, and then easily tack that on to protect the actual edges. Or you can bend sheet metal or whatever you want and then stain it or paint it to match the surface of the cabin. So I think a little armor plating is probably the most advantageous and has the longest term effect. The repellents are kind of a fallback, but you did mention lead poisoning, and if you ever find the offending porcupine in the act, then removing that porcupine from the overall population would probably be a good thing to do.
Okay.
Well, he was caught in the act, so I know he was there.
Okay. Well, that's up to you. If you or family members kind of get a kick out of porcupines,
they're
interesting animals to watch lumber
around.
Yeah, they
are. They're fun to watch.
So I don't mind seeing them occasionally, but if you can beat the siding problem with either the repellent or the armor plating, go ahead and you can have the porcupine around and kind of have your porcupine and eat it too, so to speak. but on the other hand, if that's just not feasible or too expensive or whatever, then removal of the animal either by capturing it and moving it out of the area or by the aforementioned lead poisoning will solve your problem.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot, Jim, for calling, and good luck to you. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, you mentioned woodpeckers a little earlier. You said you thought the question was going to be about woodpeckers. You're getting lots of calls about woodpeckers?
Yeah, just the last 3 or 4 weeks since it started to cool off, lots of folks calling saying woodpeckers have started to attack their siding. And it's a fairly common problem, especially with any type of natural wood siding. The T111 that the previous caller mentioned is notorious for woodpecker problems because it has a little interior tunnel in the plywood that attracts insects, and then woodpeckers go after that. But in most cases on cedar or redwood or other types of natural siding, they're just opening up large holes that they may use as a roost chamber or whatever. And it's very frustrating. It's very expensive. It can be very expensive to fix. It's not that easy to deal with. So I guess the general advice to kind of launch a preemptive strike here on any woodpecker calls is if you first hear a woodpecker tapping on your house, that's a call to immediate action. Don't wait. Don't let the problem get worse. Go after the bird immediately and do whatever you can to scare it out of there. And that can be literally physically running out of the house screaming and yelling or banging pots and pans or hanging streamers or pinwheels or owl decoys or all the other stuff that people try. But it's a lot easier to discourage the birds at the very first sign of problems than to let it get going and then have the bird really get attached to your house.
Kevin in Tomahawk, we turn to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning. We're sitting in hunting camp talking, and we haven't seen many deer up here in northern Wisconsin, but what would be your opinion of having like a slot size of, say, like 6 points or larger, say, north of Highway 64 to increase the trophy deer and maybe then in turn increase the hunters and tourists up this way? And I'll take my answer off the air, thank you.
All right. We used to have way back, there was something kind of like that, wasn't there, Scott?
There have been various things tried or talked about, certainly, and Pennsylvania implemented a point limitation a few years ago, which seems to be working for them. I think it was 6 points or better. And various individual hunting clubs or groups of property owners or quality deer management folks who are involved in that organization will set their own standards. And I know lots of clubs around the state who, you know, won't shoot anything less than an 8 point or won't shoot anything that's inside the ears, or their people get good enough at scoring that, oh, that's a 120, that's a 140, that's a 160. We're not going to shoot anything less than a 120 or what have you. That's all well and good if you control the landscape well enough with your own hunters and your own ownership pattern that you can do that. You're free to do whatever you want within the confines of the basic regulations. For hunters, however, on primarily public land, and a lot of the north is public land, that would be much more difficult to put into place, in part because while I understand what Kevin's getting at here, that having more trophy bucks in the woods would be a big attraction, the concept of what a trophy buck is varies a great deal from person to person. And for a, you know, for a kid just out on a learn to hunt program, or you know, their first hunt or whatever, heck, a doe fawn can be a trophy deer. So that's part of the problem. And the aforementioned difficulty in talking to Peter about the bear situation is, you know, will all hunters agree on such a thing? Well, they won't. And it's not unlike the baiting-feeding controversy, even amongst deer hunters. It seems to be split almost right down the middle. Oh, yeah, we're big on baiting. Oh, that's the worst possible thing to do. I would never bait. If we can't get agreement on that particular problem, which has some, I mean, there's some science there that suggests that baiting and feeding is problematic in terms of changing deer movement patterns, and there may be disease implications and all sorts of other things. If we can't make headway on that, I think, although there's some attraction to creating bigger bucks, I think getting the hunters to agree to that and ultimately having it become law would be very challenging.
Very challenging. Helgi, your turn in Arkdale. Hi.
Yeah, this is Helgi. Hi, Larry and Scott. My concern is about agricultural tags. We got a neighbor here that's got a couple hundred acres, and he hands out ag tags, you know, and it's, the deer are not here anymore. you hear them shooting all year round. And
yeah.
Well, Hilgi, I this is one of many reasons. The point limitation and a whole host of other things. One of why, for many reasons, deer management is such a challenge. It is a very difficult thing to attempt to manage the herd in terms of their biological needs for maintaining habitat and herd health and that kind of thing, superimposed on all the various interests in terms of deer numbers, ranging from motorists to hunters, hunters who want big bucks, hunters who want more deer, less deer. And it's just very difficult. And if, in fact, you happen to be located to next to or close to a situation where the group of hunters on the neighboring property has a bit of a scorched earth policy, much the same as you see with the issuance of ag tags, where a farmer is presumably suffering enough damage that they're forced into the situation of requesting these tags and then using them in order to protect their livelihood. That's understandable, but may not sit well with people on the neighboring 240 acres who are far more interested in deer hunting than they are corn production. So I don't know what to tell you about that. You know, if the ag tags run their course and the deer are reduced to a point where this particular farmer is no longer seeing the kind of damage level that they won't tolerate, then maybe things get better. Generally speaking, when we worked with farmers in deer damage 10 or 15 years ago, we found very few farmers who wanted to see no deer at all. Most farmers either hunted themselves or had a few hunters on the land or just enjoyed seeing a few deer around, but just didn't want to suffer enough damage that it was hurting them in the pocketbook. And especially in these economic times when that kind of thing hurts even worse, well, I guess I understand what's going on, but in terms of you really being able to do anything, probably not much other than swallow hard and hope for better times ahead.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Elgate, for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike in Menominee, it's on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I was actually just going to make some hamburgers and noticed that a rodent was in eating my bacon grease, probably from yesterday.
Oh,
yeah.
Wondering if there were specific health issues to humans other than just rodents being pests in your house.
All right. Are there health issues associated with having mice running around your house?
Sure. There are a variety of disease and health considerations, whether or not, I mean, I'm assuming that in this particular case, a rodent either tromping across the bacon grease or nibbling on it, that if there were droppings or that literally the animal was moving around in the bacon grease, certainly something like that should be disposed of and start with another source of oil for your cooking. And then at that point, you do something with either a trapping campaign or some bait stations or something to get the rodents out of there. It probably isn't a huge source of concern. I mean, we don't hear lots about, well, so-and-so succumbed recently to some rodent-borne disease. It's just not a common thing on the radar screen. But I think just in terms of general health and sanitation and peace of mind, most people don't want rodents tromping around on their food or jumping up on the bed with them. So I think some rodent proofing in the case of the building and some rodent control in terms of trapping or bait stations is probably a good idea.
Okay, there you go. Jim in Onalaska, on to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two quick questions, and one refers to the prey issue of wolves and coyotes and their impact on deer that you referred to at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any statistics at all, Scott, on, let's just say, an adult wolf, how many deer they will take out of the herd in a given year?
Well, all of the figures that I've seen over the years and in most of the popular literature, I've seen it ranging from 17 or 18 to maybe 20. In other words, the logic is that if a wolf ate nothing but deer over the course of a year, which they don't, that it would take the equivalent of 17 or 18 to maybe as many as 20 deer to keep that wolf going.
Uh-huh.
So if you took the worst case scenario of, let's say we have 1,000 wolves after reproduction. The population's right now estimated is 700, give or take a few. Let's say we had 1,000, just to make the math easy. And every one of those wolves ate 20 deer. That's 20,000 deer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we just said the gun hunters last week killed 218 or 20,000.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 9 or 10% of the hunter harvest just during the gun season. So in the bigger picture, okay, well, gee, those numbers don't seem like a problem. However, we've had it come up before, and it's a valid argument that the wolves aren't distributed all over the state like the deer are. So if that wolf pack happens to be 100 yards behind your hunting shack on the land you've historically hunted on, and you have an active wolf pack, then I think it's quite possible that you see effects on the deer population from localized wolf activity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And part two of my question, this is stemming from an argument with a guy I know who would just soon shoot a wolf as talk about it. Because of the impact on deer, are there any statistics on the number of roadkill deer in Wisconsin during a year?
Well, that too is open to great debate and varies from year to year, depending on how much reporting is being done and what the individual county sheriff's departments are doing in terms of response.
Mm-hmm.
So there, I think reported collisions where there's an insurance claim filed is somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000. Depends on the county, but 20,000 statewide. However, I've seen statistics where if you add in all the non-reported accidents or the deer that get hit and then crawl off and die or whatever, that it may be pushing 40 or 50,000 total.
Okay, so would it be a reasonable statement that wolves take out less deer in Wisconsin than roadkill, even though I know there's not many wolves in the southern part of the state? But
Sure. And in the southern part of the state, I mean, where wolves aren't a factor, I mean, roadkill is a big deal for a lot of reasons. It costs a lot of money to fix the cars.
Yep.
People are killed. People are injured. A lot of deer are killed. Yeah, roadkill's a huge problem, but it's very difficult to deal with. And since it affects everybody across the board, and we're so tightly linked to our vehicles that it's not something you hear a lot of screaming about.
Yeah.
You know, people don't like it, but nobody's going to stop driving because there's a risk of hitting a deer.
Yeah, there you go. There you have it, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott, we have a couple of other emails that relate to deer. Steve in La Crosse wonders how effective are coyotes in helping control the chronic wasting disease in the southern Wisconsin deer herd, and does chronic wasting disease affect coyotes?
Well, second part first. There have been a couple of, after chronic wasting disease was first discovered, there was a great deal of concern over whether all the things that pick away at a deer carcass could become infected. And they did an intensive sampling program of scavengers like raccoons and possums and coyotes and whatnot, and some laboratory studies. And at least as far as I know, there's no evidence that any of those animals have shown any effects of CWD in their own right. So that's not the issue. In terms of helping out, well, if a deer gets to the point that it's actually debilitated by CWD and is lumbering around on the verge of death, then it's probably much more vulnerable to having coyotes take it down. And the fact that they clean up that potentially infectious carcass fairly quickly and get it off the landscape is probably a good thing. Whether it's significant or not, I don't know, but it certainly isn't hurting.
Bill in Madison wonders about the reports about the deer kill is higher than last year's, still memory of higher kills, and hunters will not be completely satisfied by this year's numbers. Can you shed some insight regarding the wolf population, and I think you just mentioned this really, moving deer out of areas, a particular area, and thereby hunters concluding that there are fewer deer than there used to be? And how has the overall state distribution changed? Are there more deer in southern half now of the state than in the northern?
Well, I'm not sure where to go with that question, but in a couple of things. First of all, for quite a long time, there have always been higher deer densities in the southern agricultural units and the central units than in the north woods, so to speak. Deer simply do better in mixed agricultural lands than they do in a long spread of coniferous forest. But there are deer all over the state. There's no question about that. But the densities vary greatly depending on habitat and regulations and hunter behavior and predators and a whole slew of other things. The wolf issue we've already talked about, there can be local impacts on numbers and distribution. The notion that, yes, it is good news that the harvest is back up, but if you go back to thinking about harvests 4 or 5 years ago, yeah, they were still quite a bit higher than what we saw this year. That's not necessarily what we're seeing now is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the agency's been working hard to get the deer herd back down near management goal for the better part of a couple decades. So the fact of the matter is that these newer, lower harvests than 5 or 10 years ago are probably the new reality that hunters will become accustomed to. And, yeah, we may think back to the 90s or the early parts of the 2000s. Wow, remember when we killed 500,000 or more deer? Well, but there was considerable sentiment that wasn't sustainable and wasn't necessarily the best thing for the landscape or the deer. So we'll see.
Carolyn in Eau Claire, we're on to you now. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Larry. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you taking my call. Scott, my question for you is a two-part squirrel question. Does it matter what time of year if I want to live trap and move some squirrels from my backyard, relocate them?
Mm-hmm.
And the second part is, how far away should I relocate them? In the past, I've taken them to a park about 2-3 miles away, but somebody told me that they might come back to my yard.
Well, this is a tough question, Carolyn, because relocating wildlife from one's yard is problematic for a lot of reasons. I realize it's attractive to people because you kind of have the idea, well, I don't want this squirrel here anymore, so if I catch it and move it, it'll live happily ever after in the park that I'm taking it to. Which may be true, but it's also possibly, or it should be considered, that, hey, this squirrel's being displaced into a new environment where it has no idea where the nearest hollow tree is or where the nearest nut tree is or how to avoid the local predators or whatever. And it's perhaps just as likely in a new setting to become a problem for somebody else. So the notion of moving animals around the landscape is fraught with problems, even though I understand why psychologically it's something that people find attractive. The other issue that you need to consider is that live trapping and removing squirrels can become a lifetime occupation. I've had folks over the years who will remove, they find it actually, I mean, maybe it becomes a hobby. But one gentleman in particular was removing over a 10 or 15 year period upwards of 150 squirrels a year from his yard here in the Madison area. 150. And all that means is there are a lot of squirrels out there.
They just come right back in.
And you cannot create a vacuum in your yard. They'll continue to move in. Not the same squirrels necessarily that you tried to move to the park, but other squirrels. So solving a squirrel problem by live trapping and removal is difficult to do. So think about that a little bit as far as how far to take them. First of all, you need permission from the property manager or owner if you're going to release them somewhere. And I would go a little further than a mile or two or three, four or five at least. And if you can cross a river or a major highway, you'll minimize the chances of return.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. It really is. I know someone, too, who has removed over 100 squirrels from his backyard.
And they've still got squirrels.
They've still got just as many.
Yeah, that's right.
Just as many. Alan Durand, it's on to you now. Hi, Al.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some information regarding whether or not chickadees hoard food.
Okay.
I read in a book by John Bates that, in fact, they do hoard food. And the amazing thing is that their brain actually grows by 25% in the fall of the year, so they can remember where they hoard the seeds and then goes back to normal size in the spring of the year. How they found this out, I don't have a clue.
Never heard that.
I don't know either about their brain size, but it's certainly possible. And Bates is a great naturalist and
yes,
a very popular fellow up in north central Wisconsin,
right,
where he lives. So.
And I've observed this, the same thing the other gentleman did. We have a place in the Barnes area, and in the fall, say mid-October to late October, the chickadees, normally grab a seed, hop in a tree, and eat it. But they'll be going farther out into the woods. They'll disappear from view and then come back in again. So they're definitely, there's a difference in their pattern, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think the only thing to do is to follow a couple of them and find that hollow tree and scoop the seeds back into the bucket and back to the feeder.
Thanks, okay, Al. Appreciate the call. All right. Oh, my goodness. Bob in Blue Mounds. We're on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I want to look back on warm summer evenings.
Okay.
I'm thinking about whippoorwills, and they've made it to a type of listing with the DNR called the Species of Greatest Conservation Need.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran some numbers on the Breeding Bird Survey, the National Breeding Bird Survey for Region 3, which is for fish and wildlife, so what, the five-state region right around Wisconsin.
Right.
And between 1966 and 2007, they were declining at a rate of 2.1% per year.
Mm-hmm.
Huge decline. So I'm, and I did a little surveying myself. I drove in late June on a perfect night. I drove west and around Spring Green and Wyoming Valley area and didn't hear a single one. Went on a, you know, long drive at night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to know what your opinion is, what's going on with them in the South. I know they were never maybe as common in the South as the North, but I can think of a number of possibilities with succession, fire suppression, an increase in meso predators related to a decrease in raccoon pelt prices, possibly gypsy moth spraying or agricultural spraying, reducing the insect population. But then finally, another landowner who's lived on his land in the hills for a long time suggested that taking the cows out of the woods may be a big factor. 50 years ago, it was pretty common, or 60 years ago, for farmers to graze in the woods, which kept down the leaf litter.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know what your thoughts are and if there's any good research on it.
Well, I don't know of any current research specific to this area, but the fact that they've been placed on the list as a species of greatest conservation need puts them in a position for such work if someone has the resources or the interest to do it. I agree with you completely that when I moved to Wisconsin in the early 70s, all of my colleagues out in the Iowa County area, the very area where you've been looking around, would especially Bob Ellerson, who was a great naturalist, whom I replaced, would come into work almost every morning this summer. So, oh man, the whippoorwills were keeping me up half the night. You know, if you have one on a horizontal limb outside the bedroom window, that song can become quite incessant after a while. And we'd hear them all the time up there. I heard one this past summer up at our cabin in Price County. I said, "Well, whippoorwill, I haven't heard one of those for a long time." So there's no question about the decline. The causes of it, you already listed most of the usual suspects as far as here is concerned, but I think it's equally probable that the problem that some of the difficulties they face are not necessarily here, but rather on the wintering grounds way to the south of us. They're a long-distance neotropical migrant, and a lot of those birds have had big-time problems that are more related to what's going on in the wintering grounds than back here in Wisconsin. But I'm not saying we're entirely without blame. Either.
All right, there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Bob. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Scott, Christmas season, holiday season here, and the 34th annual Christmas tree sale coming up at the UW Stock Pavilion in Madison.
Well, that's my home department, and the forestry side of our department has had this tree sale for many years, and it's just a great event over in the Stock Pavilion. You can drive right in there where it's dry and comfortable and tie your tree on the top of the car and go, and usually I go over, or did in years past, try and help sell trees. It smells good. It feels good. Everybody's in a good mood, and they've got really nice trees. They're at a reasonable price, and most importantly, the proceeds from this tree sale go to support student activities within the department, like their annual summer camp up at Kemp Station. So it's a decent place to get a tree.
And it's December 3rd, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Yep.
8 to 8 on Friday, 8 to 8 on Saturday, and 9 to 3 on Sunday.
That's the west end of campus, just next door to the Dairy Bar, so you can get yourself a big cone of Babcock ice cream and a tree, and everybody's really going to be happy.
And as long as we're on the kind of the holiday Christmas gift ideas, there's always all kinds of those, Scott.
Oh, there's no shortage. We mentioned it briefly on the last program, but you know, things that are high on my list and always have been, you know, bird feeders, especially for folks who maybe haven't been exposed to bird feeders, a great gift along with seed. Trail cameras have become very popular, and there's all sorts of opportunity for folks to contribute the data that they're collecting on those trail cameras to wildlife conservation, all sorts of good magazines and books and resources like that to offer up a subscription to, memberships in all the various conservation groups that do good work. You know, if somebody's interested in pheasants, get them a membership in Pheasants Forever, the Ruffed Grouse Society, Ducks Unlimited, Rocky Mountain Elk, Whitetails Unlimited, and on and on and on and on. Good optics are a really nice gift, so mm-hmm. people can see up close and personal what they're observing out there. Field guides, all of our extension publications, our nice stocking stuffers. I brought you a copy of the new one this morning.
Yeah, it's a nice one.
Outdoor Hazards in Wisconsin, that talks about how to avoid noxious plants, noxious insects, and potentially hazardous wildlife, which mercifully there's not much of in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But that's all contained in that new publication. Survival kits are always a good idea. I got some pet first aid stuff for this Christmas because a couple of hunting buddies have had their dogs injured on wire fences and whatnot, and there are all sorts of good things you can carry around to help your pets. On our hunting ventures last week, a couple of our guys got turned around in the woods. In you know, even in southern Wisconsin, you can get, and we were on an island for crying out loud. How can you get lost? But the people were lost. So I said, hey, next year, everybody's going to carry a compass. Compasses are kind of like typewriters. Nobody has one anymore or uses it because they all want a GPS. But GPS are great, but they're dependent on batteries and knowing how to use them. I still think it's a good idea to carry a good silver compass in your pocket.
I carry one.
Well, it can save you a lot of heartache and get you out of the woods a lot more quickly. All sorts of beautiful wildlife art and photography, food processing stuff. You and I are both interested in game cooking. There are so many spice mixes and marinade mixes and shrink wrappers and dehydrators and grinders and all sorts of stuff you can get now. It's amazing, and I'm starting to think about that a little more since we're going to be revising our wild game cookbook.
Yeah,
here over the next 6 months or so. That'll be fun, and we'll be looking for new recipes, and everybody's got a lot of venison to cook now, so that's a good time of year to be thinking about these things.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, recipes, I should mention, if you've got a good recipe for wild game, be it venison or pheasant or whatever, send it on to my Facebook page, and we'll take a look at it and see if we can include it.
Well, that would be great. I would send it, especially what we're interested in, are, you know, tried and true family recipes, something that, you know, grandma developed.
Yeah.
Not something necessarily, if this is just something you kind of lifted out of the L.L. Bean game cookbook or the many other good cookbooks that are out there, we have to be a little bit cautious about that. So if it is basically from a printed source, just let us know that on the recipe and we'll go from there.
Yeah. So just go to my Facebook page is The Larry Mealer Show and shoot us some of those recipes. We'd love to see them. There we go. Mary in Harshaw has a question or comment for you, Scott. Hi, Mary.
Hi. The first one is about this deer. I don't know if you heard about it, but some lady in southern Wisconsin hit this 300-pound buck.
Yes.
In Richland County, the one she'd been offered $10,000 for?
Yeah. How did she get around to keeping it?
Well, if you hit a deer when the sheriff's department arrives or whatnot, if you want the deer under Wisconsin law, they can issue a red tag, a confiscation tag for it, and it's your deer if you want it.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, if you decide, no, I don't want the deer, the sheriff can decide, they usually have a list of people in some counties who are looking for deer because they don't hunt but want the venison or they want it for a game feed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they usually don't go to waste. Unfortunately, some that have been hit by cars, no one would really want to process them. It's a pretty messy situation. But if the deer is... if the deer's in reasonably good shape, usually either the person who hit it or some passerby may stop. We were watching a really big buck up at Kemp Station over the course of the fall, and just the week before the season, lo and behold, I got to go, oh, the big buck we were watching just got hit on Mid Lake Road. Mm-hmm. And it was hit by a woman who said, gee, I don't want this deer. But some of the students we knew up there had been right behind her, and the sheriff arrived, and the sheriff and the students apparently reached an agreement that they were going to divide up the meat, and somebody wanted the rack from the buck, and the woman was towed away, and that was the end of it.
Okay, good. Well, my second question is, I heard some people talking about the turkeys in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Now, they said northern Wisconsin, and I don't know what part of northern Wisconsin they were talking about, but that the DNR are going to bring in rattlesnakes.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of the great urban legends from around the country. I think the first place I heard it mentioned was in Door County, and it's spread to other areas that the notion was they were going to bring in rattlesnakes to help control the turkey population, and there is absolutely no, zero, nothing, nada, zip, no foundation to that at all. It's an urban legend. Turkeys are doing very well throughout the state, on their own, all the way to Lake Superior. And rattlesnakes, on the other hand, are a protected species of special concern, restricted only to the southwestern corner of the state.
Yeah,
not an issue.
Don't
worry about that.
Okay, because I'm a walker. I take my dog with me, and I thought, man, if a rattlesnake is up here and it gets used to the cold and everything, and I'm going, I'm not going walking.
You're not going to find one in Harshaw.
Don't worry.
No, that's good.
Don't worry about a rattlesnake in Harshaw.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. Wow, Ron, that's amazing.
It's amazing how something like that gets started and develops a life of its own and surfaces periodically over months and years.
I heard it a week or so ago from someone, and I said, that is the most ridiculous. Anyway, Ron in Newburgh, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, Scott and Larry. This sort of goes back a while, too. But, Scott, on some previous program, and I'm pretty sure it was yours, a year or two ago, people were asking about woodpeckers going after the cedar siding on the house.
Uh-huh.
And if I remember correctly, you said, well, maybe if you put out a mouse trap or two, maybe that'll do it. I put out a couple mouse traps, and the woodpeckers got smart and the chickadees didn't. And so I lost two chickadees and took the mouse traps off the house.
Yeah, the only context that we would have mentioned the traps in is that with woodpeckers, if you try all the other stuff first, the netting and the pinwheels and all that kind of stuff, and you get to the point where, hey, I just can't take this anymore, then there's a provision. You can contact the Wildlife Services people with USDA. They have an office in Sun Prairie, Rhinelander, and Waupun, and they can issue you a permit to actually kill a woodpecker. Otherwise, it's strictly illegal and would result in a big fine. If and when you get the permit, if you're in a rural area, the woodpecker could presumably be shot. If you're not, then the only tactic that has much potential is to take a rat-sized trap, bait it with suet, and nail it to the side of the house near where the damage is occurring. And that will usually catch the woodpecker. That's the first time I've ever heard of collateral damage in the form of chickadees, but I can see where on a mouse trap that might be the issue, especially if mouse trap was just put out with the notion that somehow the snapping would scare them away or something. Because a mouse trap probably wouldn't kill a woodpecker. The rat trap will, but it can only be used under the provisions of those federal permits and otherwise should not be put out at all. So that would have been the context, and that's the only thing I can think of that we might have been talking about.
Well, what's the next best? I've tried putting netting over the side of the house, and they just land on it, and when it pushes in with the wind or something, and their claws seem to be able to catch onto the siding right through the mesh even.
Yeah, if you're going to use the netting, it has to be suspended from the roof line, away from the siding, a good 3, 4, 5 inches, and then either tacked or Velcroed or stapled or something down far enough so that it has enough tension that it can't press up against the siding. Otherwise, they will, if they're persistent, either hang on it or go right through it. But in the absence of the netting working or any of the scare tactics or whatever else you've tried, my suggestion is if you wish, you can go the permit route and then destroy the birds.
Yeah, I'd prefer not to. So I'm looking for, because I just don't want to have any more chickadees get.
No, yeah. I understand. And most people don't want to hurt the woodpeckers and don't go the permit route. And certainly if there were other birds being harmed, then that's a big problem. But
You might try tacking that material so that it won't.
Or put some spacers. You can put some spacers down over, say, a window casing or something like that to keep that siding away, and that may work. Otherwise, if you do go the permit route, if you're out in the countryside, a pellet gun or something like that might be better than the trap, and then you know you're dealing with the woodpecker. You have the permit to remove.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. Talking wildlife today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Thank you so much for listening in. Appreciate it. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll do our best to get you on the air. Andrew in Lake Mills has a question for you, Scott. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I got a question about some squirrels. I tend to have move into my attic every year. I fixed the problem last year by patching, but how do I get them out in the midst of their, they make noise all through the night?
If you're hearing things at night, are you sure they're squirrels? I mean, yeah. Is it possible they're flying squirrels? Or do you see them? Do you think they're regular gray squirrels?
They're regular gray squirrels.
Okay.
There's a branch that comes to the roof. They like coming off the eaves trough. And we patched it last year, and somehow they got in there again.
Well, if you can, there's a couple possibilities, Andrew. If you can find the hole they're using, the Tomahawk Live Trap Company, which is up in northern Wisconsin, is a very popular brand of live traps, makes a device called a squirrel excluder. And it looks sort of like a trap, but it only has one door, and it's spring-loaded, and you mount this thing over the hole they're using, and they come out, and they push their way under this spring-loaded bent door and leave, but then the door, the spring, closes it behind them. And they can't get back in.
Can't get back in.
So if you use that for, maybe have it employed for a week or so during moderate weather when they're going out to feed, then you can assume pretty safely that, hey, they're all out. Now you go up there, take down the squirrel excluder, and cover that hole with hardware cloth or sheet metal or something they can't get back through, and end of story. The other option is to go up in the attic if you can get up in there, and you could live trap them in the attic and take them out that way. And the third option is most mammals, raccoons and squirrels and so forth, really don't like naphthalene flakes, moth flakes. And if you throw a bunch of those around in the attic near where they're using, that may drive them out for a few days so you can make the repairs that way too. But be careful with that, because you won't like the smell of the naphthalene either. Yeah. And if that works its way down into the, bedrooms or upstairs or something, that's not going to be good. So be careful with that. But I think the squirrel excluder is the way to go.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Myra in Rolling Lake, thank you very much for calling. Myra, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. What can we do for you?
I'm wondering where the bluebirds go after the end of June or early July. We had at least two pair nests, maybe two nesting, two nests where they had babies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, they left about the end of June or early July, and then didn't see them until around October 21. I looked out the window, and here there was a whole flock out by the bird bath, and then they disappeared. And I was wondering, where do they go between that, and do they stay as a flock?
Well, this is a it's kind of a common observation with a lot of birds that are either seasonally dependent on our feeders or the nest boxes we put up for them. Not unlike the robins on your lawn that seem like they're everywhere through the spring and early summer, and they're nesting in the shrubs around the house, and the bluebirds are in the bluebird boxes, and everything's great, and they're all over the place, and then all of a sudden, boom, where'd they all go?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, they're still around, maybe not in the same habitat or right around the yard, because they're no longer as dependent as the robins are on that early spring moisture in the lawn, or the bluebirds on the nest boxes, or a number of other species. They don't necessarily clear out of the area, but they may be using different habitats, and they're preoccupied by raising their fledglings and taking care of other things, and we just don't see them as much. They haven't really gone anywhere in the sense of, you know, migrating further north or anywhere else. And then all of a sudden, as fall, late summer rolls around, and these birds are gathering up again to migrate or have different needs, you start to see them again as they're moving out for the winter. So it's more of a case of behavioral change and differential visibility than it is any case of them simply, you know, clearing out and heading up into Canada for the summer.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We had an email from Dean in Tomahawk. He says, I thought that you and Scott would like this. He says, my wife was coming home from work about 2 weeks ago when she saw she saw her neighbor who has medical problems standing by the road. She stopped to see if she was okay, told her that an eagle was down in the field and couldn't fly. Her cousin stopped, and between the two of them, they got the eagle, took it to Antigo Rapture Hospital. Raptor Hospital, I'm sorry, Rapture. Raptor Hospital. We keep checking on them, and they think he was lead poisoned, but is making a full recovery.
Great. Excellent. That's a good story. There was another really good one about a trumpeter swan, member of a pair, that had been shot and found in a wetland up in northwestern Wisconsin, and that one was taken in, rehabbed, and released. And lo and behold, they found it back with its original mate about 50 miles from the site, so that they were back together again, and everybody's happy. And those are good stories, especially this time of year.
Anna in Madison, it's on to you now. Hi, Anna.
Hi there. First of all, I just have to say I was staying in a place near the Mississippi River and heard whippoorwills for the first time. So it was,
good.
That was just this summer. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. My question is, I'm terrified, actually, of hitting a deer while driving down the highway. And I'd like to, if you could discuss both the times of the evening and night when they're most active and most likely to be traipsing across the road, and also what kind of, like, what I should be really paying the most attention to in terms of what's along the side of the road. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Wow. Very good question, Anna. First of all, let's kind of scale this down. In terms of times of the year, worst possible time is late October, early November during the rut or breeding season, when the bucks in particular are running every which way and are thinking about absolutely nothing other than the breeding season, and they'll even run into your car. You don't hit them, they'll run into you. So that's a time of year when you have to be especially observant. Especially here in southern Wisconsin, with the now numerous deer seasons, almost continuous from September through, I think there's even going to be a winter hunt this year,
right,
in the chronic wasting disease area, there's always the chance of deer being disrupted by hunters and moving across a road or onto a road. And that would be primarily daylight activity, but at least you can see well then. So the hunting seasons, early spring, when the snow is finally melting off and the deer that have been kind of confined by deep snow can finally move around freely, that time, fall hunting, and the rut around early November, those are the three seasonal peaks. In terms of daily activity, it could be really any time, more night than day, but certainly early morning or late evening just at dusk. That's when they're most active, and it's also the time when visibility is the poorest. So those are the times to be particularly cautious. In terms of individual behavior, deer crossing signs are placed where they are for a reason. Those are usually areas where there have been a history of deer vehicle collisions. So pay attention to the deer crossing signs and be observant then. And you have to kind of develop your peripheral vision. you need to keep your eyes on the road. You can't be scanning the fields and forests and not watch the road. But out of the corner of your eye, you know, you're kind of watching the roadside for movement. When it's dark, you're looking for eye shine from the animals in your headlights. And boy, if you see a deer or think you see something or the right shape or something doesn't look right, you've got to slow down. And if you do see a deer run across the road, the best strategy is to assume that there's another one right behind it. And that's what you need to worry about. And then the final advice is, if you're in a case where, wow, there's a deer in the road and I'm going to hit it, you are probably better off. It may not seem like it, but I think generally most people advise you to drive right through the deer rather than, unless you're certain that you can either stop or swerve or something, certain. Swerving generally gets people into more trouble than hitting the deer. You're going to go off the road and hit a tree, roll the vehicle, go into the path of another car. It's not going to be a good thing to hit the deer, but you're more likely to come through that better than if you hit a tree or another car. So those are some of the tips, but it's really a matter of being observant and being sensitive. I don't think anyone needs to drive terrified, but if you know the seasons and the times of day and what you're looking for,
and slow down,
you'll be fine.
Chris emailed wondering how soon after deer meat has been processed and refrigerated should it be frozen?
Excuse me. Well, in terms of the deer I processed last week, and I cut up four, I was very nervous early last week when the temperature hit the mid-60s for a day.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, it cooled off very quickly. And if temperatures are at or near freezing, or the deer is actually in a cooler or locker, depending on the animal, some people strongly support aging the meat, you know, up to several weeks, as long as it's stored right around 40 degrees or less. If it's out in a barn or shed and you're waiting for processing and the stuff more or less freezes up, it can keep for a good long time. If someone gave me a package of venison that was thawed, I'd treat it no differently than a package of beef from the grocery store. A couple days in the fridge, and then if you're not going to use it, put it in the freezer. Venison freezes very, very well, and there's no reason to try and keep it fresh.
Bruce in Black Earth, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Larry. I'm on the shore of Lake Mendota right now enjoying my lunch, and I'm watching a whole close to 100 swans and geese and waterfowl out here. My question is, are these tundra swans?
The odds are, if you're seeing, that's not to say that there might not be a pair of trumpeters, you know, mixed in, and then you should be looking for a neck band on the birds to see if you can spot them. But University Bay was covered with them for most of last week. I don't know if they're still down there or not. So there were a lot of tundra swans, formerly known as whistling swans, moving through now. And you can see them for miles. They're so bright white against the dark fall landscape that they're very obvious, and they're just passing through on their way to the East Coast where they'll spend the winter, and then they'll be back again in the spring. So they're kind of neat to see right now, but the odds are certainly way in the favor that these are all tundra swans.
Thanks. My second question was, are they the same thing as what used to be known as whistling swans?
Yeah. Same bird, thing. Just that the ornithologists and bird people are constantly tinkering with names. The Baltimore Oriole became the Northern Oriole, and then I think they moved it back, and whistling swans became tundra swans, and it's just part of the territory.
There you go, Bruce. Thanks for calling. Joe and DePere, on to you. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Last year on Christmas night, it was around 9 o'clock, my dog just kind of went nuts. He started barking and howling and running around the house. I don't know what's going on here. I looked outside. I didn't see anything. So I took him out, and I found out in quick order what he was all upset about. I heard an owl.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, but I didn't know. I never saw it. So I went to work the next day and asked the people at work, anybody know owl be all around here? And they said, well, why don't you go on the internet? So I got home from work and logged on to owlsounds.com, clicked on three or four of them. Fortunately, the dog was in the room and went nuts again. I found out what kind of an owl it was. Yeah, it turned out it was a great horned owl. I never did see it.
Yeah.
But getting close to the breeding season.
So that's what I was wondering. What's going on? Is it December? They breed in December?
They breed. They're probably our earliest nesting bird, and usually by late December, certainly into January, they're beginning to hoot in every woodlot and bit of wooded habitat around the area, and they're setting up their nesting territories and getting ready to nest. So they do nest under winter conditions, and things are ready to go when the young ones are ready to go when spring finally rolls around. So they nest very early.
How do I see them? This was, it's pitch dark when I heard them.
Well, you'll hear them all night with that deep booming hooting. In terms of seeing them, look around the area for a big tree that may have had a hawk nest or something like that in a fork of the tree, and then just watch that, because they'll very often reoccupy a nest like that, and you'll just see this big oblong dark shape occupying the nest. Otherwise, the only other way you'll see them out during, you'll see them or find them, is to listen for the crows or sometimes the blue jays. If they find one out during the day, they'll mob it ferociously and just set up a horrendous cawing and screaming. And if you go find the crows, you'll find the owls sitting there hunkered down saying, geez, I wish these crows would leave me alone. But that's one way to see them during the day.
No, my neighbors have a tiny little dog. I'm not worried about my dog. He's a German Shepherd. But what about this? Do the neighbors have to worry about it with their little whatever?
I don't think so. I guess in my 30-some years of doing this, I've not had anybody lose a pet to a horned owl. But a little dog or a cat out does face some wildlife threats, the most notable of which are coyotes in this area. So I would just be very observant of any small pet like that for a variety of reasons, but horned owls wouldn't be too much of a problem.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling.
I sort of thought he was headed in a different direction. Christmas night, racket outside. I thought we were going to the roof to look for reindeer, but anyway.
Susan in Coon Valley, on to you. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Just a question about coyotes. We have a pristine 80 acres in the valley with water and just an abundance of wildlife, turkeys, owls, deer, whatever. But my question is, we used to have more grouse and pheasant, and the coyote population seems to be getting larger and taking its toll. And I'm wondering if your guest has any information about the number of coyotes, if they're increasing in numbers, and if they're taking toll on bird life.
Well, we've mentioned it a bit before with regard to predation on deer and turkeys that folks are concerned about, and they're opportunistic feeders. They'll eat whatever they can catch, probably more so pheasants than grouse. But the problem with grouse in southwestern Wisconsin, they've virtually disappeared. And these are areas where, when I came here as a graduate student in the 70s, there were many grouse and excellent grouse hunting, and they've virtually disappeared. There's one of my colleagues, a faculty member at UW-Richland Center by the name of Scott Walter, has been working on that for the last 5 or 6 years with what few grouse they've been able to find and mark. And this is a reflection of gross changes in habitat in southwestern Wisconsin as a lot of old farms and fields have grown up. The habitat is not as suitable. There are a wide range of predators out there. And as a result of fairly natural phenomenon, not really human activity per se, grouse have all but disappeared. And coyotes may play a minimal role in that, but there aren't enough grouse left for coyotes to have much of an impact on. Pheasants may be a little more at risk, but they've suffered in the past, that winter when we had 115 inches of snow, and the winter before it with all the ice, pheasants virtually disappeared around my property. So
there you go. We have an email from Muriel in Lone Rock. My husband puts out mice bait, an anticoagulant type. If a mouse eats the bait and a hawk eats the mouse, will that harm the hawk? Also, if our cat eats a mouse and then that ate the bait, will it harm the cat?
Generally speaking, the rodenticides, which are all anticoagulants, which the average homeowner or citizen can now buy and use, are generally not that hazardous for secondary poisoning, which is why they're still readily available in the marketplace. The stuff that had a higher risk of secondary poisoning is generally unavailable to homeowners and citizens. There's a possible problem if there were a lot of mice, but simply a mouse killed by eating decon and then eaten by a cat or a hawk is not going to be an issue, you know, unless there's some unusual sensitivity. If there were a lot of mice involved or they were getting into the bait directly, then that might be more of a problem. But I don't think this is something they need to be overly concerned about.
We had an email from Christy from Potosi and heard you talking about shrews earlier. She's wondering if she has a shrew or a vole. She has a greenhouse attached to her house, which unfortunately attracts a lot of mice. I set mouse traps and lately have been catching what I thought were voles. Very dark gray, short-tailed, and have a pointed nose, same size as a mouse.
Those are short-tailed shrews. The vole, which is the same size, will have a short tail as well, but they're more brownish. The face is blunt and it rather than pointed. And if she really wants to know for sure, just peel back their itty-bitty lips and look at the teeth. And if the animal has these two big paired orange incisor teeth typical of a rodent, then it's a vole. If they don't, it's a shrew.
There you go. And she also had some other points, but one relating to finding dead animals that some local trapper, she assumes, were dumping in a gully. So far, they have three mallards and a skinned coyote. Do you report that to the DNR?
You can report it to the DNR or the sheriff or whatever. Fundamentally, it's littering and it's a stupid thing to do. But when I was pheasant hunting on the Brooklyn Wildlife Area last week with son Jeff, we found two goats, a couple of deer carcasses. And I think, unfortunately, people don't know what else to do with these carcasses, don't want to put them in their trash, so they either dump them somewhere out in the countryside thinking, well, the coyotes will clean them up, which may or may not be true, but it's still a form of littering,
yeah,
and that's the way it should be treated.
We have some deadlines coming up, Scott, that we should mention.
For folks who are interested, and we've been talking about turkeys and bears and things like that, and there's an important permit deadline coming up, which is next week on December 10th. And that's the deadline for applying for spring 2011, next spring's turkey hunting periods, which start in mid-April. So the turkey permit deadline is on the 10th, and there will be 225,000-plus turkey permits available. And then it's also the deadline for applying for bear permits for next fall's bear hunting season. And those are also very popular, although the number of permits has not yet been set. But it's been going up dramatically in the past couple of years because of the recognition of a larger bear population.
John from Minocqua says, while getting my BS in wildlife ecology at Stevens Point, I did a study of the homing instinct of red squirrels. The short answer is they were infallible at returning to their home territory from as far away as 3.5 miles.
Uh-huh. Okay, so 5 miles is reasonable.
Yeah, he used radio collars and tracked them back to where they came from. All were back home within 30 hours.
Holy cow.
Only one did not make it back due to predation that we found the transmitter. Anyway, if you insist on relocation, you need to go pretty far.
Well, it's another reason why it's just very labor intensive and not the greatest idea.
Not the greatest idea at all. Any difference between an albino deer and a white collared deer that has normal color to the eyes and nose? That's a piebald, isn't it?
Well, piebald or leucistic. We've talked about this a bit before. There's a couple of conditions that can result in light coloration. Other than albinism, the true albino is going to be white with pink eyes. And that, of course, is a popular phenomenon up in the Boulder Junction area and some other parts of the state.
Well, Scott, you are going to be back with us the first Wednesday of January.
Next year.
Next year. Wow. And when, I don't even know when that first Wednesday falls. I'll have to look that up.
Well, I think the Rose Bowl is Saturday the 1st. That's kind of a big deal here in Madison right now. So it must be 2nd, 3rd, it must be the 5th, I guess.
5th. 5th, right.
We'll be here.
Jim Packard's holding up five fingers. He says the 5th. We got it. Thanks, right. Scott.
Well, happy holidays to everybody.
Scott,
see you then.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Tomorrow we'll talk astronomy with Paul Kinsler at 11, and then 11:45, Janet Jenkins talks consumer protection. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.